We're reminded on a regular basis that this book we all have is an amazing book, the Bible, made up of 66 different documents from Genesis to Revelation, 40 authors, 3 languages, was written on 3 different continents, some in Africa, some in Europe, some in Asia, over a period of over 1,500 years. In other words, when the Bible first began to be written, the earliest books, such as the book of Job, America hadn't even been discovered yet. In fact, Great Britain hadn't even become a nation yet. It was just coming out from under the rule and reign of the Romans and trying to sort out the whole thing of the Angles and the Saxons and the Scots and the Irish and who was going to be in charge. And so much has happened in history from that day in 500 A.D. or A.D. 500 until today. And yet that's the period of time over which the Bible was written, in different places by different people at different times. And yet it is so much like one book that as soon as the world discovered how to make books and not just scrolls, they started putting all these documents together under one cover. The last pages of our Bible were written some 1900 plus years ago. That's the last of the writing. And yet, 1900 years later, this book of 66 ancient documents is still the world's bestseller. Any other book that rises briefly to the status of bestseller claim doesn't hold a candle to what the Bible sells every year, year after year. And it's revered, read, studied, and treated like a guide to life and as a direction to heaven by almost one-third of Earth's population, even today. So what is the likelihood that any such collection of 66 ancient documents bound together as a single volume would still be surviving 1900 years after the last pages were written? Well, I don't know what the chances are, but the fact is no other such set of documents has survived. The Bible is the only one that has not only survived, but thrived, and still has such a tremendous influence over the thinking and lives of so many people in our world. And this is in spite of the fact that during these 1900 years, since the pages were last finished, there's been almost a continuous assault upon it by people of all stripes and ideologies, whether theologians, philosophers, historians, scientists, educators, kings, dictators, emperors, or even just madmen who have sought to destroy either it or its influence. And yet it has withstood all such assaults and still withstands them even today. We see on a regular basis in our media, whether it's newspaper, magazine, books, television, assault still continuing today. And yet its truth, its integrity, and its teachings still remain untouched, except by those who wish to believe something else other than what it has to say. The latter part of our Bible, the 27 documents that make up what we call our New Testament, we're referring to right now in our study as the Jesus documents, because they are the ones who tell us about this person who was born, lived, taught, did amazing things, and died 2,000 years ago. But they also record for us that he rose from the dead and said, before he ascended into the heavens, that he was coming back and that we were to await his return, being faithful to the things he had taught in our lives until then. Now, last week, we looked at some of the evidence contemporary to the Jesus documents, some of it direct evidence and some of it just circumstantial evidence that supplies support for knowing that these documents are telling the truth. Because one of the assaults that's always being made against the Bible is that it's not recording accurately what actually happened. Either that it's myth and legend, or that facts are manipulated and changed to misrepresent the real truth. By and large, those who propose all these things propose some kind of a giant conspiracy theory that somehow the ancient believers, who were people of just ordinary circumstances and means, and who face a large amount of persecution by the culture and society around them, had somehow hit upon some master conspiracy that over a period of several hundred years, somehow, that they were going to manipulate the truth and hide what really happened and force upon mankind some fantasy, some untruth concerning Jesus and what he said and did. And somehow they not only foisted this conspiracy, a falsehood upon mankind, but in the process managed to hide completely that such a conspiracy was going on. The truth is, that's more unbelievable than what we're actually reading in the pages as truth. Even for those who choose to not believe that miracles are possible, who choose not to believe that there is a God in heaven and that he sent someone to this earth, that he called his son to do these things, even those that reject that should see such a proposal as that is more unbelievable than even believing what we read here. And yet that's what they're really suggesting. No such evidence exists of such a conspiracy. Instead, what does exist, and we saw some of that, just a small part of it last week, is evidence from contemporary documents of the time, some written by historians, some written by other people who, when they happened to mention or talk about something that reflected on the same things mentioned in the text of our New Testament, it always confirms what we read. We talked about how there were archaeological evidences that confirm that people from the very middle of the first century, as early or even before AD 50, were already burying their dead with inscriptions and marks on the caskets, or ossuaries as they were called then, bone boxes, with marks and inscriptions on them of crosses and of inscriptions that begged that Jesus would raise these people from the dead, which clearly showed that within 20 years of the death of Jesus, people were already believing, even if we didn't have our New Testament, that Jesus could raise their dead loved ones to life again. Now, where would such a belief come from if it's not a confirmation of what we read in the New Testament, that Jesus himself rose from the dead and promised that all those who followed and believed in him would be raised from the dead as well? But other archaeological discoveries that confirmed that Pontius Pilate was actually governor of that part of the world at this particular period of time, something that for a great long time skeptics of the Bible denied, claiming there was no evidence for it. But now evidence has been discovered that supports that. Evidence that there were these growing communities of people who believed these things about Jesus within 20 years of when he died and supposedly rose from the dead and went back to heaven. And that these groups were able to spread this teaching about Jesus, not just in faraway places that weren't close to where the actual events happened, but actually began right in the very place where it began, among the very people among which it happened. And were able to convince them that this was true, and they should believe it, and they should give up everything they had held dear all of their lives as a part of their former religion and beliefs, and become believers in Jesus. I suppose it's one thing if you come up with some fantastic story about someone who supposedly lived in a certain place and time and did certain things among a certain group of people, and then you travel halfway around the world and try to convince people over there that that's true. But it's something else again, try to convince people right in the very place where it happened in their lifetime that it happened, when in fact the whole thing is a falsehood. Clearly, the evidence from contemporary sources show that from the very beginning, people believed this was true. And immediately, those who believed in him started practicing certain things that memorialized some of the essentials of what he was all about. They baptized their converts, claiming that this is the way that they receive forgiveness of their sins and entered into a right relationship with God, therefore confirming that they believed from the very beginning he was a Savior and had been a sacrifice for their sins. And they practiced on a regular basis at least weekly, and in some evidence even shows even more frequently than that, something they call the supper. We call it communion, in which they said as they broke bread together and drank together from a cup, they said they were doing this in remembrance of Him, to remember that His body was given on a cross and that His blood was shed that they might be saved. These are no inconsequential things. If we were talking about anything else other than the beginnings of the Christian religion, any historian anywhere, any scholar anywhere would say this is more than abundant evidence to prove that these things really happened. But because it involves religion and because it involves, in some cases, miraculous, people tend to be much more skeptical about the same thing that they would otherwise believe was true. But now we want to turn our attention today with this subject of the Jesus documents to talk about how these first records that are purported to have been written either by eyewitnesses of Jesus or those who were alive at the time of Jesus and had access to the eyewitnesses, how these documents were actually propagated or carried on from that original time until now. This is another area in which the skeptic and the critic attacks the Jesus documents all the time. They'll make comments like, well, they've been copied so many times and translated so many times into other languages that what we have today bears scarcely any resemblance to what the original was like. But we just simply need to say, what's the proof for that? You say it as if that should be obvious to everybody, but what's the evidence for that? In fact, all the evidence is the opposite. The evidence is that as they were copied, and even as they were translated into other languages, that those who were doing it believed these were the very words of God, and they took extraordinary effort to make sure that they transmitted it accurately from one document to another. Now, there are little hints in the pages of the scriptures themselves, these Jesus documents, of how some of this first began. But I'm going to spend a moment and review for you what more conservative scholars, even those who aren't necessarily Christian believers, have sort of appended to these documents as the probable dates in which they were written. If we think about the fact that Jesus probably was born around 3 BC by our modern ways of counting time and probably died around AD 29 to 30 AD, or AD 29 and 30. You're supposed to always put the AD in front. And now they're even changing it where they no longer say AD, which originally stood for Anno Domini, the year of our Lord. Now they want to say CE instead of AD and take the Lord's name out of it altogether. But whatever the case, they say about AD or CE 30. But then when we start looking at these documents that make up our New Testament, even not the most conservative scholars will say Mark was probably written somewhere between 55 and 65. That's some 25 to 35 years later, the written form of it. That Luke was written probably between 60 and 70, some 40 to 50 years later. That Matthew was at least was written by AD 71 to 80, somewhere in there, putting it between 40 and 50 years out. And John being the last of it, somewhere between AD 80 and 90. Even in that case, being only 50 to 60 years later. And in every case, they will say that the actual stories, events, teachings that are found in these four books called the Gospels, the stories were already being circulated widely among the believers from the very beginning of the church until these books were actually written. And so the argument is that the written copies were preceded, or actually were a follow-up to, the oral stories already being told by those who were eyewitnesses of what had actually happened. And so for someone to make a written copy and for it to be in any way substantially different from what was actually the spoken stories would immediately be rejected by the whole community as being untruth and unreliable. And therefore, these have to be accurate reflections of what was already being believed and taught among the people even before anything was written down. realize that that doesn't in and of itself make them true, but it does reflect the fact that the people who wrote them and the people who received them, those first generation and now the beginning of the second generation of Christians, all were totally convinced it was true and not some kind of conspiracy story or fantasy story that's put together that had no basis in reality. Now, as we read our New Testament, I got to thinking about this. I said, do we have anything in the New Testament that tells us where those first recipients of these documents, whether it's the Gospels, we've just mentioned dates on those, or whether it's the book of Acts, which seemed to have been written just a year or two after Luke was, or if it's the actual epistles, that is the letters of Paul, which actually the earliest of the writings. Even more liberal scholars are now willing to say that the first of the letters of Paul was probably written around AD 46, only some 15 or 16 years after Jesus' life on this earth ended, and was written by a man that even they, the more liberal scholars, are willing to say was at first an opposer and a persecutor of those who believed in Jesus, but who himself became a believer. And so some just 15 or 16 years later, he starts writing letters that we still have today. And the last of his letters probably written around AD 62 or 63, the year of his death. And so we have these very early documents. But do in any of them, do they encourage people, those first readers, to take these documents and make copies of them? Well, I couldn't find any such reference. I could find some things that sort of came close, but no actual references. On the other hand, we know in fact from history itself, not even having to do with Christianity and religion, but it is true of history itself, that when documents were written in the days before the printing press and copy machines and all of that, copies were always being made of them. In ancient Egypt, before the time of Christ, there was in the city of Alexandria a great library, and it's estimated by some that there were as many as 200,000 scrolls kept in that library, that a great king had set aside a great amount of money and had made it a great project of his, and those he hired to run this library he built, together what he considered the world's knowledge. He wanted, in effect, to have his own world book encyclopedia, even before the days of Jesus. And so they had brought in scrolls from all over the world, and he would send his own men out with money in their pockets and authority from him to buy copies of other scrolls from all around their known world. Even went so far as when ships would put into the port at Alexandria, his soldiers would board the ship and search the ship to see if there were any scrolls on board. And then the scrolls would be taken into the library, and his scribes there would write out copies of what was in those scrolls if they were of any importance. It wasn't just things like manifest and bills of goods and things like that. We're talking about scrolls that actually had knowledge in them, books of astronomy, books of biology, books of philosophy or whatever it was. And they would actually make copies of these scrolls. And sometimes his scribes were so competent at what they were doing that then the copy would be sent back to the captain of the ship, and he would be none the wiser to know that he now had a copy, not the original. And yet the original he had itself was a copy that had been purchased at some time, maybe when he was in Rome, maybe when he was in Greece or somewhere. And so there was this widely accepted, well-known process in the ancient world that when an original book, as maybe we would call it today, was written, even though it was on scrolls at that time, not in page form like ours, that copies would be made by competent people so that the copy would be, in most respects, undifferentiated from the original. And then later copies could be made of it and of it and of it. And yet in their day, a bestseller might be something that 100 copies was made of. That would be a bestseller for them. And so with that as a background, when we approach these documents, we shouldn't be surprised that the early Christian community over the first, from the period of the beginning of the church in AD 30 in Jerusalem to the end of the first century, just 70 years later in AD 100, was already involved in making sure that copies of all these documents were being made and distributed. For one by one, the apostles were dying, most of them violent deaths under persecution. And that whole first generation of people who had known the apostles personally, and some at least whom lived in the Holy Land had even known and seen Jesus personally, were dying off. And you don't have that first generation of witnesses anymore to be sort of living books. And so you're left with a written form. And so copies were being made. Now, no original manuscripts are known to exist today. That is, as far as we know, we don't have the first written edition, copy of Mark or Matthew or Luke or John or the letter to the Ephesians or any of that. Now, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist out there. It is possible that some still exist, but they haven't been found or identified if they do. But to the ancient mind, to people who lived in that time, the original was not necessary. If a good copy had been made, that was as good as the original. That's still true in our culture today. You don't always have to have the original of something if you have a copy that you're confident is in all material nature just like the original. A copy is sufficient. And so it was for them. And so while we don't have the originals, we only have these copies, we have to ask the question, is that a problem? No. Because, practically speaking, no original documents of any kind from that period exist today. That is, of books that were of any consequence. Now, yeah, they found in trash heaps in Egypt where the remains of this trash had been buried in the sand, and because of the weather and the lack of humidity and all of that, they've survived in bits and pieces over all these centuries until finally someone digs up this ancient trash bin or trash heap and find in it little bits and pieces of personal correspondence between people, or maybe a bill of goods or a receipt that someone had written up for someone else. And yeah, those are the originals. No one would have ever needed to make a copy of them. And even they were not preserved. They'd been thrown away. But for more substantial things, the writings of the philosophers, the writings of the historians, the writers of the court reporters of that time, none of those originals exist today. Only copies, if even copies exist. And yet no one questioned whether or not these are valuable sources of information about what this philosopher believed, or what this historian wrote, or what this emperor did and said. They recognized that that's sufficient to satisfy. And so then again, when we turn back to the Jesus documents, they're in the same situation. We have today copies of the originals. And over the next few centuries, as scholars now look back at what we have, and more is being discovered all the time, we have, I've seen different numbers, somewhere between 4,000 and over 5,000 copies of parts or all of the books that make up our New Testament in copy form from those first few centuries. And they're scattered all around, or they were scattered all around the ancient Mediterranean, from places like Carthage and Egypt to the south and up the eastern coast of the Mediterranean, of Judea and of Syria and of Antioch and in the Asia Minor, which is today Turkey, and across through Greece and into Rome, and even all the way over into Gaul, which is today France and Spain. We have these copies, thousands of copies of these Jesus documents. And while some want to make a lot about the fact that there are minor differences between some of them and what they say, there's two things that scholars ultimately have to agree upon. Number one, the changes are not substantial and can be explained by simple mistakes by those who are doing the copying, because while we had always liked to think that those who were making the copies were professionals at it, the truth is that sometimes, because of persecution and because of need, it might be just an average person with just an average education for that time actually trying to make a copy. And so he might occasionally misspell a word, even though he has an original here to copy from, or he's hearing someone read it while he's trying to write down a copy of it. Those were the two ways they usually did that. He might misspell a word occasionally, and even once in a while might actually put a different word in. It was a synonym of the word that was in the earlier copy he's hearing from. And so then if someone later gets this copy he made, then that's going to be propagated, isn't it? The next person is going to say, well, this word looks misspelled, but the copy I've got is misspelled, so I better put it just that way too. And so first of all, there are what we would call errors in some of these copies. Misspelled words, sometimes a word substituted for another word. But number two, no incident in the life of Jesus, no doctrine that is taught in the pages of these Jesus documents, no practice of that first century church is in any way touched by any of these. None of these errors, as they're sometimes called, copyist errors, scribal errors, affect what the text says. And by and large, scholars are easily able to identify those errors and know what the original did say. There's a whole field of study, not just of the biblical text and the copies, but of ancient documents in general and how they're copied. A whole field of study that specializes in recovering the original version of the text from the copies we have, in which people are highly qualified and people are highly confident in the results that they get out of it. And so even though we only have copies, and yes, there are some changes, errors, we might call them, that have been introduced over the centuries in some of those, they in no way affect what the text teaches. And scholars are continually confident that they know what the original said, even if some copies had a misspelled word in it or a changed word in it. But do we read in the text itself some intimation that they, in fact, did expect it to be copied? Well, we hear Luke, as we read often, at the beginning of his gospel, saying something that intimates that very thing. For he says in Luke 1:1, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Right away, Luke is telling us two things we already acknowledge. That the written stories didn't come first, but the spoken ones. Did you hear him say that? Just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the Lord. Secondly, he is telling us that he's not the only one who has been writing it down. For he says, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. And by the way, he's using that expression and how he'll now use it to describe his own writing as an account. He clearly is talking about written account. So apparently, even beyond the four Gospels we know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, others were, just for the sake of supplementing memory, already writing down at least some of these things that were being said and told and taught about Jesus. But over time, the early church only identified four of them as comprehensive enough, reliable enough, and accurate enough to depend upon. All the others dropped by the wayside, or never was even included in the first place as possible possibilities to include along with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as accurate accounts. So clearly Luke is already talking about people are making up accounts and that he is doing like they are. And then he says in verse 3, therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, so he's claiming that he is taken a great deal of effort and is at least making the claim that he intends to be accurate in what he's recording here because he's carefully investigated it. That it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. So he's telling this person that he's dedicating his book to, which many books in that ancient time were dedicated to prominent benefactors or even sometimes the emperor or the governor or a ruler or a leader of some kind. He says he's writing this for Theophilus' sake so Theophilus can know the accuracy and the certainty of what he's already believed, which he got no doubt from oral teaching. And now it's taken the form of written teaching and what Luke has done. But he doesn't mention that more copies of this should be made. In fact, though, we know that would be the practice in the ancient times. If it was considered valuable and useful for others besides just the first person receiving it, then copies would be made, and copies of those copies, and copies of those copies. And so we see him mentioning that. John does the same thing at the end of his gospel in John chapter 20 and in verse 30. He says, Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing you may have life in his name. John says, I wrote this book so people could believe in Jesus, so they'd have a written, accurate record of what he said and did, so they could believe in him. Well, does he just want the number of people who could see this one copy to be believers? No. The intent in writing such a thing would be that it would be copied and that it would be distributed. Even though he doesn't say that in so many words, that would be the intent. And so that as many as possible might become believers. And he closes out the whole thing in chapter 21 and 25 by saying, Jesus did many other things as well. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have room for the books that would be written. He's just saying he had to choose and pick what were the most appropriate things to write, because if he tried to write everything, he would have never finished the book. And it was taken many more than the one he did write. Or even our passage that was read at the beginning this morning, in Paul's letter to the Colossians. We don't have any record exactly where Paul ever visited the city of Colossae. It was in the interior, off to the east of Ephesus, about 160 kilometers, which I think is close to 100 miles in the interior from Ephesus. Paul spent 2 years plus in Ephesus teaching and preaching. And among the people he came in contact with, apparently both there and later while he was in Rome, were two people, or three, from Colossae. First of all, was a man by the name of Epaphras. Epaphras was from Colossae, and it's with Epaphras that Paul sends this letter to the church in Colossae. So Epaphras becomes his delivery person. He's sort of his mailman to take it there. But there was also a man by the name of Onesimus who lived in Colossae. We don't know exactly how Paul met him. Perhaps Onesimus had come from Colossae to Ephesus on business. He seemed to be a well-to-do person. Paul even writes in the letter to, I've got this reversed, the man's name is Philemon. Paul writes a letter to this man Philemon. We have it in our New Testament called Philemon. And he says, I hope to come see you and I hope to stay with you when I come. But the reason Paul actually writes the letter to Philemon is that while Paul was in prison in Rome, he came in contact with a runaway slave there by the name of Onesimus. And it turns out that Onesimus had run away from Philemon. You know, we sometimes talk about coincidences and all that. That's just too big a coincidence. That Paul, probably while he was in Ephesus, had come to know a businessman in Colossae by the name of Philemon. And then years later, at least 5 or 6 years later, Paul is in prison in Rome. And while he's there, he comes in contact with, maybe because he's actually in jail there, a runaway slave by the name of Onesimus. And when it all gets sorted out, it turns out Onesimus was a slave of Philemon. Of the millions of people who lived in the Roman Empire, how could that happen? Except God made it happen. But Paul writes a letter, not just to Philemon, which we have, but he writes a letter to the church at Colossae, where Epaphras and Onesimus, later on, and Philemon all lived. And after he writes this letter to them, at the end of it, he says in Colossians chapter 4, and starting in verse, we'll start with verse 12, because that gives us more of the context. Epaphras, who is one of you, and a servant of Christ Jesus, sends greetings. I think it's generally thought that that Colossians was written while Paul was in Ephesus. And so he says that one of you, by the name of Epaphras, sends his greetings. He is always wrestling in prayer for you, that you may stand firm in all the will of God, mature and fully assured. I vouch for him that he is working hard for you and for those at Laodicea and Hierapolis. Colossae was part of a tri-city area. There were three cities that were all just within about 10 miles of each other. Colossae, Hierapolis, and Laodicea. They were all located along a major trade route that ran through the interior of Asia Minor that carried trade back and forth from the east to the west. And he says, our dear friend Luke, the doctor, and Demas send greetings. Give my greetings to the brothers at Laodicea and to Nympha and the church in her house. And after this letter has been read to you, see that it is also read in the church of the Laodiceans, and that you in turn read the letter from Laodicea. So he says, I'm sending you this letter, but after you read it, make sure that the church in Laodicea, just 10 miles away, also gets to read it. How are they going to get to read it over in Laodicea? Certainly they could have sent the original over, but almost surely they made a copy. And he mentions also that he's at some point written a letter to the Laodiceans, which we don't have. But he said, not only should you make sure the Laodiceans get to read this letter I'm writing to you, but also get the letter I wrote them and have it read to the church in Colossae as well. So clearly there's implication that copies should be made. Well, there's so much more to be said about this, so I'm going to stop right here. There's so much more to be said about these copies that were made and the fact that we have more than just the copies to help us know what the originals look like. This is crucial information for us. This is important that we understand this, not only to fortify us against the critics who want to just wave this all off as unimportant because they're on a mission to try to destroy people's faith in these documents. But it's also important for us to have an answer to those that ask us, a reason for the hope that we have within us. We need to be able to tell them that we have sufficient evidence that these documents have not been changed, that they have been preserved, and that they are accurate and historical in their. And we can put our trust in them as telling us the truth about Jesus, and therefore the hope that we have.